This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're here and ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel in the studio. Here we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
Good to have you here, sir, after a bit of a reprieve. And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
We are going to start with a religious dispute that exploded this week within the Russian Orthodox Church, a dispute that has major geopolitical ramifications. For this story, we'll go straight to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so one of the world's largest religious communities is the Orthodox community. There are 300 million Eastern Orthodox Christians. So, I mean, you're talking about a substantial percentage of the globe's population. And it looked like this week they could be splitting in two. The Russian Orthodox Church on October 15th, they severed their ties with the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, who's the head, or at least the first among equals, of the Orthodox Church. Now, the Russian Orthodox Church is important because it is by far the biggest. In fact, about half of Eastern Orthodox Christians are Russian Orthodox Christians. So you're looking at this group basically splitting in two now.
Okay, and so the first of all, what precipitated the dispute, and what are the ramifications? Why is this so important, geopolitically speaking?
Well, this is one of those discussions where you see religion and what's going on the ground going very closely together. So no secret that Ukraine and Russia don't really like each other. Mm-hmm. You've had movements for Ukraine to distance itself from Russia, well, basically going all the way back to ever since Ukraine was incorporated as part of the Soviet Union all the way back in the 20s, all the way back, you know, decades ago. And as part of that push from Russia, there's been push for a religious separation as well. So for hundreds of years, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church has come under the Russian Orthodox Church. And those Ukrainians that want to separate themselves from Russia have really pushed to get their church separate from Russia. And there have been various different pushes for this. There was a very significant one in the 90s when Ukraine broke out of the Soviet Union. But leading up to this breakaway, the Greek Orthodox Church basically finally responded to that and said that they were going to recognize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church as its own separate church, no longer under the Russian Church. And that's a big deal for Russia. I mean, the Russian Orthodox Church is a tool of the Russian government. You know, Metropolitan Kirill Andrew spoke on this a week or two back. He's very probably a KGB agent, or at least an ex-KGB agent, very closely in Russia's government. This is a tool for Russia to control a lot of people, which is, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship. They both benefit. Russia locks people in jail. If you criticize the Russian Orthodox Church, in return, the Russian Orthodox Church helps support the government. They help support each other. So now you've got Ukraine breaking away from that. That significantly diminishes the Russian Orthodox Church's reach into Ukraine. It's a major disaster or a major loss for them. So they've basically gone full nuclear and said, we're pulling out of the whole Orthodox community now, and we're going separate. It's one of the biggest schisms in Christianity, going all the way back to, I don't know of anything bigger than this in terms of numbers, going all the way back to the Protestant Reformation. I mean, if one of our listeners does, I'm more than well happy to be corrected on that. I'm not completely certain, but I certainly can't think of anything.
Mm-hmm. So putting this against the backdrop of this geopolitical conflict between Ukraine and Russia, how does the Russian Orthodox Church going nuclear in this way affect things going forward? It seems that for Russia to essentially say, well, if we're going to lose that control over those Orthodox believers in Ukraine, their influence would actually decrease there. How does this play into that gamesmanship?
Yeah, that'll be very interesting to see. There, it could just, like Andrew brings out in his article, make the split even worse. Because, of course, there are some within the Orthodox, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that want to stay loyal to Russia. And so you could see this split now taking on a religious dimension. It's also, you know, the Eastern Orthodox Church said they were going to recognize Ukraine as being their own separate church. They haven't done it yet. So there's also still the possibility that they might back down. And I wonder if that might be what the Russians are hoping. It's interesting to note that just days before Russia had their big invasion and just in the whole run-up of them taking Crimea, Vladimir Putin went to visit the Pope. So he's been aware of this religious aspect of this division for the whole time. So he's a very canny and clever individual. He is... managed to get the Pope in the few occasions in the past to kind of back him and the Russian Orthodox Church over the Ukrainians. So it's not over yet, and maybe we'll just see this dispute taking on a more, even more rancorous division. But if this division remains permanent, you have this splitting of Christianity in much more solid Western and even Eastern and Russian, or Russian and anti-Russian camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting to see this, that even the religious dimension of this, because it's definitely the biggest split in the Eastern Orthodox Church since 1054 AD. That's when, because the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church used to be the same church, and you had these five bishops. You had a bishop in Rome, a bishop in Constantinople, a bishop in Antioch, and one in Jerusalem, and one in Alexandria, and it was the bishop of Rome that kind of tried to start exerting more authority over the others. And so the church split, and that's why the Patriarch of Constantinople, Richard mentioned earlier, he's called the first among equals. Mm-hmm. Used to be Bishop of Rome who was first among equals, then they split, and then it kind of default went to this Bishop of Constantinople is like the number two guy, is now the number one guy. But the Russian Orthodox Church is now accusing him of doing the same things, interfering in their own Russian affairs like the Pope was doing. with some of the other churches 1,000 years ago. But the current Bishop of Constantinople, Archpatriarch Bartholomew, he's had a fairly long reign. He's been in office as the Ecumenical Patriarch since 1991. And he's most famous for two big changes in the Orthodox Church. The one is that he's really responsible for warming relationships with the Vatican. For before that, mm-hmm. the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Vatican were kind of cold shouldering each other, and he restored at least friendly talking terms with the Vatican. But now he's also looks like he's maybe splitting his own church in half by alienating the Russians. So I mean, you could see. I think there's currently 15 or 16 Russian Orthodox churches. So if there's a split and those 150 million Russian Orthodox go their own way, the other 150 million or so Orthodox Christians may have that millstone cut from their neck and drift right. much closer into better relationships with the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, that seems like that really could be the a major outcome of this, that if you're talking about eliminating that Russian influence within the Orthodox Church, then the Orthodox and Catholic churches could be much more likely to come together, which is something that we would expect to happen based on biblical prophecy.
Right. There is that prophecy we've mentioned many times before in Isaiah 47 about a mother church that has lost daughter churches that says, I won't suffer the loss of daughters or sit a widow. And it's a prophecy we've brought on this program before. Mentioned in more detail in our He Was Right booklet, but that talks about those daughter or churches that split coming back under Rome's control. And this is the kind of something that with the Archpatriarch of Constantinople is pretty close with the Roman Catholic Church right now.
Mm-hmm.
Archpatriarch of Moscow, not so much. Like I said, if he's a former KGB agent who's right. good friends with Putin, I mean, they do have dealings with the Roman Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, but they're he's definitely got his own power source with the Russian government. He doesn't need to cozy up to Rome in the same way someone like the Archpatriarch of Constantinople does. He's running a small Christian church in Islamic Turkey. He's much just political considerations. He's much more in favor of closer ties with the West and with the Western religion.
Mm-hmm. So does this have any geopolitical ramifications in terms of Ukraine's future? Because we've been talking about this. Where exactly is the line of geographical separation between Russia and Europe? And if we're seeing maybe the makings of more religious unity within Europe and including some of those in the Orthodox world, does that also kind of reflect? Is that reflected geography somehow?
I think that's a tough question. I think, you know, like Andrew said, the main prophetic tie for this is that without this now Russian millstone around the Orthodox neck, they could move much closer to Rome much more quickly. I think for Ukraine, I mean, they've wanted to be part of Europe for a while, and there's been a strong push from them. On the other hand, though, there's just been very little from Europe to reach out and grab that hand. You know, they've been trying to reach out to Europe, and Europe just hasn't really been reaching back. You saw that where there was just a couple of occasions in the run-up to this whole thing where if Europe had just scraped together a few billion, they could have essentially bought Ukraine. They could have paid the prime minister off, gotten them to stick with this on this roadmap to eventually joining the European Union. They weren't interested. There's a lot of things they could have done to oppose Vladimir Putin more. They weren't interested. We've talked about on this program, this pipeline deal that Germany's doing with Russia that will make it much easier for Russia to cut off Ukraine's gas in the middle of winter. And they've insisted on a few kind of paper guarantees from Russia saying that they won't do that, but nothing too much. And then even the Pope has been pretty lackluster. And in fact, the head of the Catholic Church within Ukraine has been, or the Orthodox Church that is in communion with Rome within Ukraine, it gets a little complex. But anyway, that individual has been very critical of Pope Francis because he hasn't done more to reach out to Ukraine and to help defend even Catholics in Ukraine. So, yeah, Ukraine seems like they want to go towards Europe, and you see this as another sign of that. Whether Europe will respond, though, there's not been much sign of that yet. And if Europe don't respond, it's very hard to see how Ukraine can maintain their independence against the huge juggernaut that is Russia within the long term. So I think we may well just be facing another chapter in the long history of Eastern European countries being thrown under the bus of relations between Central Europe, like Germany, and Russia, which... then that's another prophecy that we're watching, this relationship between Russia and Germany and the two of them coming to some kind of temporary arrangement about exactly countries like Ukraine.
Well, it'll be very interesting to watch the ripple effects of this decision by the Russian Orthodox Church. We appreciate you bringing that to us. And if you want more information, do go online to thetrumpet.com and you can read Andrew Miller's article, Ukraine on Verge of Orthodox Jihad. We appreciate that, Richard. Sticking with this subject of Russia, its military aggressiveness has a lot of Europeans on edge. Some newly publicized satellite imagery of its military activities is adding to their concern. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was new satellite imagery that was made public on Wednesday, and it shows that Russia is engaged in major upgrades and weapons buildups at least four of its military bases in Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad is not geographically connected to the rest of Russia. It's like Alaska is to the U.S., just a separate chunk of land there. And Kaliningrad lies on the southern edge of the Baltic Sea, just about 250 miles from Germany. It shares borders with Poland and Lithuania. So this Russian territory really lies just right on NATO's doorstep. And because of that location, Kaliningrad is an area that's long been of great concern to European nations. The concern is mostly just because of all the weaponry that Russia has stationed and deployed there. Kaliningrad is home to Russia's Baltic Sea Fleet. Russia has a nuclear weapons storage bunker there. And now this new satellite imagery from ImageSat International, was shared with CNN on Wednesday, and it shows that a major modernization is underway in at least four locations throughout Kaliningrad. These developments include new upgrades to Kaliningrad's nuclear weapons site, and there's also work to expand the Primorsk port. And they also show Russia significantly upgrading the Chokolovsk airbase. And then the Russians are building a new railway and also 40 new bunkers. So it's a major buildup of Russian military installations, and it's happening right inside the heart of Europe.
So Europeans who are watching this happen are going to draw their own conclusions about what Russia's strategy is or what its motivations are for this buildup. How are they viewing this?
Well, that really is the main significance of this development, is just the effect that it's having on Europe. This is really just the latest act of Russia, you know, worrying Europe with its all kinds of different provocative activities. We've seen the poisonings in the UK there recently. We've seen meddling in elections, cyber attacks of all different kinds, colossal displays of military power with these military drills that Russia's been holding. Russia is really on the rise, and it wants these European nations to see that. And on the show last week, we talked about how all of Russia's efforts to kind of divide Europe, which it does in a lot of these cyber attack strategies especially, but all those efforts are backfiring in many cases, and they're actually acting as a force of unification for the nations of Europe. And it's not difficult to see why that would be the case. These European countries see the Russian shadow lengthening and darkening, and they know that in order to be able to challenge that, they need to, you know, be able to contain it with sort of a unified force. So they're very worried, and it's causing them to sort of want to lay aside some of the disputes that they have and just become more unified.
So looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, this is obviously, we talked about it last Friday, but maybe you can just put it in context for us.
Sure, yes. This is it's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has actually been forecasting for about 15 years now. One of the earliest examples that I found about that came back in 2004. That was just after Vladimir Putin had manipulated a Russian election just to ensure his continued power. And Mr. Fleury said those kinds of acts of Russian behavior would frighten Europe into uniting. He wrote an article at that time called "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy." And the article compellingly shows how Russian aggression and Putin's moves toward dictatorship would, quote, hasten the uniting of the European Union. And he explained that his forecast about that is based on Bible prophecy. He quoted parts of Daniel chapter 11, which says, "Tidings out of the east and out of the north will trouble a power called the King of the North." And he goes on to explain that this is about modern-day Russia and some modern Asian nations frightening modern-day Europe. And, you know, in the 15 years since that was written, Putin's Russia has only grown more dictatorial, more provocative, and the combined effect of all that, including this new weapons buildup in Kaliningrad, is working to unite Europe. So we'll be sure to have a link to "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy" in the show notes.
Very good. We appreciate that. And Jeremiah also has a video that will be going up on the website about this Russian military buildup in Kaliningrad. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. For several months, Palestinians in Gaza have been escalating their war against Israel with rocket attacks, and Israel's options for responding are narrowing. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Even before the actions of this week, there was a growing conversation in Israel amongst in the public, journalists, within the government as well, about what to do about Hamas's control of the Gaza Strip. For the past 7 months, they've been having this run at the border with their terrorists and other motivating more of the civilians as well inside the Gaza Strip to rush at the border in Gaza. They're sending over all these explosive balloons that land in kindergartens, people's houses. They are there to do damage to Israeli territory and also to set fire to crops and forest lands, which are very rare in Israel. I think there's about 10,000 hectares that are, or what is that, 25,000 acres that have been burned from those. And then it's the incessant rocket attacks, what to do about those. And so at many meetings over the past couple of weeks, and as pushed by the defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, Israel has decided that it really does want to send a message to Hamas to at least stop the aggression somehow. And so they've been trying to figure out what's the best way to do that. And then the prime minister came out earlier this week and said that there are going to be plagues, basically the biblical word plague that was used, is going to be sent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip for what they're doing. And then we had Wednesday's actions, and that's where from the Gaza Strip was fired two Grad rockets, and one of them completely destroyed a house in Beersheba. That's more than 40 kilometers away, quite a substantial distance. This hasn't happened, I don't think, actually causing destruction like this. I know that there was some that were fired at Beersheba before, but to actually have a shot like this, a hit like this, was surprising. The payload that it packed was surprising. If you look at footage of this, there's someone on thetrumpet.com. The house is basically gutted. There was a woman with her three children in the house. The red alert siren came over Beersheba. Everyone is supposed to run into their shelters, which every house has by law. And she grabbed her three kids, two of them that didn't want to get out of bed. She just grabbed them, dragged them down into their safe room, closed the door, and the house was destroyed. Mm. I mean, if she didn't do that, like the next door neighbor fella that didn't even hear the red alert siren go off, he just heard the boom, there would be four casualties, and there would be probably more talk about this in the international media because of that. It did come at a time that where Israel was already thinking of a substantial response. And so since that, the call from the public has been that although we don't have a long-term solution for Gaza, we need to hit Hamas extremely hard as soon as possible.
So we're looking at this point like we're on path to war.
Yeah, I mean, that's what all the government officials are saying. The games, the rules of the games are changing. And, you know, The question is, though, what is Israel's policy, or what's its end goal of this war? There have been numerous, you know, ideas put forward. Let's cut off Hamas from Gaza. Gaza from Egypt. We'll control the Philadelphia corridor there. Let's push Hamas back 300, 400 meters from the border with Israel so they can't rush it. Let's do a full-scale takeover back of Gaza. Or let's just start taking out Hamas officials, assassination style, and then bomb head of Hamas headquarters inside Gaza. All of these, though, as even Carolyn Glick noted in her piece this week, all of these policies don't have a long-term solution. It's likened, as they call it over here, to mowing the grass. You'll mow the grass every few years, and that's what's happened 2012, 2014, wars against Hamas. And then within a couple of years, they're back. They're back with the rockets. The 2014 attack, Israel is said to have taken out 3,000 of the 9,000 rockets that Hamas had. And so what do you do? And it was just really interesting reading this piece from Carolyn Glick, who kind of has generally she has some pretty good solutions for Israel's issues. And at the end of it, I'll just quote her. She says this: in the coming days and weeks may and should see a significant escalation in IDF offensive strikes against Hamas targets in Gaza. But no matter how successful they may or may not be, they shouldn't be seen as anything more than a military version of mowing the lawn. And just as grass grows back, so Hamas will rebuild its strength. Israel's challenge is not to uproot the grass, but to maintain the capability to keep it as short as possible. Who knows? Maybe one day the Palestinians will get tired of fighting and there will be peace.
Not a lot of hope.
That's how she ends it.
Yeah, so where does Israel go from this point? I mean, looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, Israel, in many ways, it's been in this this kind of war of attrition against its enemies in the region for quite a long time. When political pressure against the the leadership within Israel ramps up, historically, that's when they've kind of taken more desperate measures. The fact that the Palestinians control Gaza came from one of those more bold efforts on the part of Israeli leadership to resolve the situation once and for all. Are we leading up to maybe a situation where Israel would take more desperate measures?
I mean, as far as everything I've read, that is going to happen. Israel has to do it. Israel's going to have to be forceful. They've only got a certain window of time before the international community starts condemning them for their disproportionate use of force, which happens every single time.
Yeah.
And so they've only got a short window to do this. I mean, there is no real long-term solution to the Palestinians in Gaza when you have them ruled by a group that declares war on Israel, and you've got 2 million Palestinians there. Israel can't take that territory back. And so Israel has, you know, gone into a situation where it is hopeless with this, with what's going on in Gaza. It doesn't have solutions. Many in Israel settle for 5 years of calm. That's what Avigdor Lieberman said. We're going to hit them hard and hit them strong, and that'll hopefully get us 5 years. 5 years! That's not a long-term plan. That's not a long-term strategy. And so, I mean, we look at this as being one, an effort by Iran, one of its fronts of Iran's warfare against Israel. And we also look at the Israeli-Palestinian crisis in context of them reaching out to foreigners for help. The Bible says that they're going to reach out to Germany to try and help them work out a solution, a long-term solution here with the Palestinians. And that looks like it's brought on. Israel's reach out to Germany is going to be brought on by some type of violent force from the Palestinians. So the fact that Israel is hopeless in this situation, doesn't have a solution right now, it does indicate that they are getting to the point where really I think God wants them. God wants them to recognize the fact that they don't have a man-made solution here that's going to work out. But as far as furthering Bible prophecy goes, we are getting to the point that they're going to try solutions that they would not have considered in years gone by. And maybe one of those will be to reach out for Germany for help at mediating this crisis.
For more information, where would you send people, Brent?
If people want to follow up on this, they can read an article that was actually written by you back in 2007 when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip, and it was entitled "Why the Hamas Victory Won't Last." That was 2007. That was 11 years ago, and we still hold true to what it says in that article, so they can go and read that.
All right. Well, we will definitely keep our eyes fixed on that situation. We really appreciate you bringing that to us. I'm sure that the coming days and weeks will prove to be very interesting in how that situation progresses. We appreciate that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. With 2.5 weeks to go before midterm elections in the United States, a very volatile situation is developing with a massive convoy of migrants coming toward the United States from Central America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, immigration has been just really in the news a lot lately. This actually happened last year. We reported it on this program, but this year even bigger, where there's a convoy from Central America publicly heading towards the United States. Last year, it was only a few hundred. This year, it's up to 4,000 Honduran immigrants that are publicly making their way towards the United States. The Guatemalan government let them pass through without much resistance. I think the leader of it was finally detained at the Mexican border, so we'll see if it breaks up or not. But even that only came after President Donald Trump really got quite strong that Mexico needs to do something to stop this, or he's deploying the military to the Mexican border. Mm-hmm. Already called up some reserve forces from the National Guard to help patrol the Mexican border. And so we'll see in the days and ahead whether anyone from this this convoy from Honduras actually makes it the distance across Mexico to the United States. But it is just quite a bold move. There's obviously been a huge illegal immigration problem for 2 or 3 decades now. And it, at least in the past year, it's gotten worse. And now you're starting to see things like this that are just even like publicly not trying to like sneak across the border, but even with some fanfare, just it's almost kind of like a invasion force in some ways, I guess, whether it gets here or not, where I say that we know we're illegal, but we're organizing like a battalion to just walk up and cross the border into the United States, mm-hmm. knowing that in many cases they will be successful in that because border security in America today is just so bad.
So there are at least some people out there speculating that this has been put together or encouraged by George Soros or similar type political advocates in the United States who are trying to make the president look bad. It does, in some ways, whether or not that's true, in some ways this does really pit the two sides on the immigration debate against one another. Those who really, like the president, are standing up and saying, you know, this is the most important issue to the United States. He's willing to even sacrifice this trade deal that he did with Mexico over this issue if Mexico doesn't stand up. From those who are more open border, let's let the immigrants in. How do you view this politically, how this might unfold so close to the elections?
Right, because midterms are only a few weeks away, so it definitely wouldn't be surprising if there's just some political posturing ahead of that, because that is something like having someone who is really concerned, like a conservative who is very concerned about border security, seeing their president show his willingness to send the military to secure the border if need be, could be an effective strategy for getting votes. But also, if you're a liberal who's really for open borders, and you're seeing that you have a president who's willing to use the military to close your borders, that could make you more likely to get out and vote for the other side. So whether it's been planned by, I guess, George Soros or some other group like that or not, I think definitely the effect is we'll see more political polarization mm-hmm. over immigration in the election this year. And probably because this caravan is so public, I don't know how many of those 4,000 people will actually make it into the United States. But it does just highlight how intense that problem is. I think we had an article go up on the website last week where they did some new, at Yale did some new studies coming up with some more efficient ways to calculate how many illegal immigrants have come into the United States, how many illegal immigrants have died while they've been here, how many illegal immigrants have willingly left the United States or been deported, and estimates that there's between 20 and 30 million illegal immigrants in the United States, which is 2 to 3 times higher than the normal figure.
Right. We've been hearing 11 million for years.
Yeah, 11 million. Yeah, because they normally like that, because obviously we know how many legal immigrants are here because they filed paperwork. And then based off the census forms, if you take how many people we think are in the United States, period, and then subtract the citizens and then subtract the legal immigrants, whoever's left over is here illegally. Mm-hmm. That normally comes out to about 11 million, but it's also very reliant on the fact that
you're self-reporting.
There's 11 million illegal immigrants here who are so confident in their status that they're willing to like sign a census form.
Right. Yeah. So there really are several explosive political issues here. One is this massive immigration population within the United States, but at the same time, you have this instability within Central America and Mexico that are creating a lot of these migrations. The people who are escaping violent conditions down there that is putting this kind of pressure on America's southern border. Maybe you can just talk about this in the context of what the Bible says about the United States and this kind of issue.
Right, because, when we've reported before that I think like up to 10% of Venezuela's entire population has fled the country due to their economic meltdown there. And then there are places in Central America where like 1% of the population gets murdered every year in drug cartel and gang violence. And so you definitely have this huge wave of immigrants coming up into Mexico. And actually, Mexico's had a little bit of a reprieve, gotten a little bit more stable the past few years. But now that it looks like the drug cartel violence is kicking up again, you could even see a resurgence in Mexicans trying to flee their country in a way that they were doing 5 or 6 years ago. And so this,
there's always the possibility of criminals and terrorists basically moving along with a crowd like this and making their way in. And the president, President Trump, is certainly making that claim that this isn't just only people who are fleeing from violence. This also includes a criminal element.
Right, right. No, definitely, because especially, like I said, 1% of people in Honduras are getting murdered each year, but a lot of gang members, teenage gang members, leave with the refugees. And even to get across the Mexican desert, oftentimes you do have to get some assistance from a drug cartel where they even partner with people who aren't necessarily looking to be in a life of crime, but being like, well, hey, the cost of us getting you into the United States alive is you've got to take this package of cocaine and deliver it to such an address and such a time. Mm-hmm. But this is something that you hear so much on the left about actually wanting open borders. And then you hear more rhetoric on the right about how we need a wall to close the border. But there's a very specific prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 about open borders, where that Deuteronomy 28 is often referred to as the blessings and cursings chapter, because it's addressed to Israel, saying that if you follow my laws, these are all the blessings that'll come upon you. And if you disobey God's laws, these are all the cursings that will come upon you. And one of the curses, it says, I guess just breaking into verse 52 here, it says, "And he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down wherein you trust throughout all the land. He shall siege you in all your gates throughout all the land which the Lord your God has given you." And I think earlier in that chapter it talks about foreigners whose language you don't understand coming from a far country into your land. But it's basically talking about a time when, because the nation has not obeyed God's laws, that foreigners will just flood into the lands. The high and fenced walls will fall down. Mm-hmm. And so I guess anyone who says open borders are a good thing disagrees with God's assessment in Deuteronomy 28, because it's listing that, like, not having control over your borders and foreigners whose language you don't understand flooding into your country is one of the curses that's listed in that. And you can say that you'll build a border wall to stop it, and that's maybe has some logic to that. But I mean, this is a very specific prophecy that the high and fenced walls are going to fall down because the people have turned away from God. So you can try to build a wall, you cannot try to build a wall, but if the root cause of, like, rebellion against God's commandments isn't addressed, you'll build a wall and it'll come down. Mm-hmm. I actually think I heard there's a joke going through the taverns of Mexico, or at least was last year, that if Trump builds his wall, 30 million drug-crazed Americans will tear it down brick by brick.
Right. All right. Well, we appreciate that. We're going to have to move on, Andrew. But you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Iran's strategy for threatening Israel, China's new stealth bomber, complications in Britain's exit from the European Union, and violent division within America playing out on the streets of Portland. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Iran has been stepping up its belligerency toward Israel for several months. A Jerusalem Post article this week discussed the Islamic Republic's strategy for doing this. We'll hear about that now by going back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this article in the Jerusalem Post is entitled "Understanding Iran's Strategy for Threatening Israel." And it's interesting because it looks at the it talks about the media reporting and the, just the general Western analysis of Iran's threats against Israel, and says that a lot of the time people don't really believe that Iran means what it says. And while the world was concerned or is concerned about Iran's push towards a nuclear weapon, this article talks about how its conventional warfare strategy against Israel is extremely concerning and something that should be noticed and countered with force. I'll just quote the article here. It says, many Western analysts highly underestimate the existential nature of the repeated threats by Iranian leaders of the destruction of the destruction of Israel. One popular American Sunday morning talk show host dismissed the threats as empty rhetoric, saying they really don't do much about it. And it says here that, I mean, the proof is in what Iran is doing right now. And the article goes through the resources that Iran has dedicated towards propping up Hezbollah. We talked about in the first part of the show about Hamas. Hamas, you know, has access probably to 10,000 rockets, where Hezbollah in the north has 10 times that. And they are funded to the tune of $1 billion a year by Iran for this conventional warfare approach against Israel. And now Israel has to come to terms with the fact that Iran has encircled that country. While it's important to be focused on the nuclear angle, the conventional angle is what would really get Israel, considering they have second strike capability as a nuclear deterrent against Iran. But you have this situation now where even when we talk about what Israel can do against Hamas, they're limited. They're limited because of Iran's aggression. Do you divert resources to attacking Hamas in the Gaza Strip and leave your northern border vulnerable to Shiite militias that now occupy the territory in Syria and north and southern Lebanon with Hezbollah there and their fighters and their missiles? Israel has to really weigh these options. The Western world looks at it as thinking Iran won't really try and attack Israel to that degree. Iran doesn't really want to destroy Israel completely. They don't really want to take Jerusalem, even though they say all of that. That's what they say openly. And this author is saying that the proof is out there for everyone to see, to the tune of billions of dollars a year. Iran really does want to destroy Israel, and they are getting the means to do it.
Well, that certainly is consistent with what the Bible says and what we've been saying based on those prophecies in the Bible for some decades now. Where would you send people for more information, Brent?
If you want to read up about Iran's desire for Israel and how these aren't hypothetical threats, it really means them, you can read this article. It's entitled The Precious Jewel in Iran's Crown.
Well, thank you very much, Brent. China is about to make its first test flight of a dangerous new weapon, some say a game-changing weapon. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Tuesday that Chinese media said China's newest long-range strategic bomber will be unveiled next year. This announcement came less than a week after reports emerged saying that this bomber was very close to making its first flight. That was reported by the government-run Global Times on October 9th. And in that report, military experts said that the new bomber, which is called the Hong 20 or H-20, has passed its test for avionics systems and hydraulics, which means it can now advance to the next phase of testing, which is trial flights. So this is, it's really big news for a bomber that's actually been in development since the early 2000s, some even say since the late 1990s. It's been in development for many years, and now most of the major hurdles have been crossed. So this highly advanced bomber is apparently just months away now from hitting the skies.
So why is this so critical for China strategically?
Well, right now the main bomber that the Chinese Air Force uses is the H-6. That's it's a Chinese copy of the Soviet era Tu-16 Badger, and those first debuted back in the early 1950s. So the H-6 is quite an obsolete aircraft in many ways, mostly in its stealth capacity. It has almost none of that. So the jump up to the H-20 is a really significant one in terms of what it changes for China's capability. I've got a quote here from the analysts at the Warzone Wire. It says, quote, "By going straight from that H-6 bomber aircraft to the new H-20 stealth bomber, China will skip multiple generations of bomber concepts that have come in the interim. Carrying a full load of CJ-10K air-launched cruise missiles, which can carry a conventional or nuclear warhead, the aircraft could give China an entirely new long-range strategic capability to deter potential opponents." And then from there, it talks a lot about the expanded range of the H-20, and also just its expanded carrying power when it comes just to sheer weaponry. So it's really a great leap forward for China's Air Force. And then this Warzone Wire piece goes on to explain how the bomber will be critical. It'll be they will be critical tools helping China defend its territorial claims in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. So the South China Sea is just a huge part of what makes this new bomber so significant. We've spoken on the program several times about the vital importance of the South China Sea, mostly because it's one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% of total global trade passes through the South China Sea each year. It's also very resource rich. And China has been relentlessly trying to assert control over this vital sea in the past few years. And it looks like the new H-20 bomber will go a long way in helping China to do that. So it has huge implications for global peace, because Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said China's tightening grip on the South China Sea is, quote, steering the world toward war. That was in an article from the July 2016 Philadelphia Trumpet. And one quote from that article says, "Since World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. Now, the American military is retreating, and China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And Mr. Fleury wrote that his analysis of the whole South China Sea dynamic there is founded on Bible prophecy. He in that article, he mentions Deuteronomy 28, verse 52. That's the same passage that Andrew talked about in the first half. And Andrew just talked about how it has implications for foreigners flooding through the gates of America. But there's also an implication here about sea gates, strategic sea lanes, such as the South China Sea, being passed from control by the U.S. and U.K., which are in that passage called the nations of Israel, to their enemies. And Mr. Fleury just explains in that article that China's rapidly expanding military capacity and strength really shows how quickly this prophecy could be fulfilled in the South China Sea. And the H-20 will just make that even more imminent.
All right. Well, we sure appreciate that, Jeremiah. It was always known that the divorce between Britain and the European Union, voted on by the British 2 years ago, would be messy. But with the deadline for Brexit coming quickly next year, the extent of the complications is becoming clearer. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I come with big news. Nothing happened this week.
All right.
That's my story for today. Now, this was kind of the big week, the crunch time week for Brexit. There was a major meeting on Wednesday of European leaders, and ahead of that meeting, everyone was basically saying, look, if we want to get a deal done for Britain to leave the European Union in March, well, now's the day. We'll have to get pretty close to a final agreement. Fine, maybe if there's a bit of small print to sort out later, but today's the day. We have to get that outline agreed. And it didn't happen. Instead, about the only thing that emerged was the possibility of maybe pushing Brexit off until, I think, December 2020. So basically off until 2021 and having some kind of transitional arrangement in there. It's actually, I don't know, I found it funny. Nobody wants to claim credit for this idea. Instead, Theresa May announced that this idea emerged. The idea of extending it emerged. That's now going to be my excuse of, it emerged that I'm not going to get this article finished on time.
Right.
But they've not done it. Although that even that's not agreed, and a lot of people in Britain don't like it. So this whole European situation, this week was kind of make or break time, get it sorted out time. It's not, and everything is as big of a mess and a muddle as it was before.
So there's quite a lot that this tells us about the state of British politics. Brad McDonald talked about this in his trumpet brief on Thursday. Maybe you could give us a brief condensed version of that.
Yeah, one of the great points I thought he made in this brief that is that, well, he wrote, the lack of the political and moral courage to implement the will of the British people, well, more than anything, this is a crisis of character and leadership. This is the main reason why Brexit feels so utterly intractable. And I think that really is the case. And that's the impression that so many people over here have, that we had the vote on Brexit, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, and none of the leaders had any kind of vision or idea of where do we go from here or any guts to put something forward. And instead, we're just left in this mess. It's a symptom of a number of things. It's a symptom of just how weak British leadership has become. Mr. McDonald also brings in there, it's a symptom of just how disastrous EU membership itself was. Mm-hmm. And that getting out of it, we're starting to realize more and more what a disaster that was. And he talked about how Herbert W. Armstrong forecast, even before Britain joined the EU, that it was going to be a disaster for Britain. So there's a lot in that trumpet brief. I'd really urge you to go and look at that. Yesterday's potentialities, today's realities, it's called.
All right. Thank you, Richard. One last story on the program today. Some ugly scenes playing out in the streets of Portland, Oregon this past week that highlight the depth of the social and political rifts within America. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, protests from the left-wing group Antifa have been getting more and more common, especially in the last 2 years in America. They had another one break out in Portland this weekend between the Antifa group and a right-wing group called Patriot Prayer, which is also becoming quite well-known for being involved in street fights like this. Now, Antifa, we've talked on this program before, was... The original group, anyway, was founded in 1920s Germany as like a front group for the Soviet Union, a communist group that tried to drum up support for communism by fighting with the Nazis. In its more modern incarnation here in the United States, Nazis are harder to find. Occasionally, like Charlottesville, Virginia, you might find a couple of them that will give them some publicity, but they usually have to look for groups like this Patriots Prayer group, which is just a group based on like free speech rights, constitutional free speech rights. Ideologically, they're not shouldn't be very controversial at all. Mm-hmm. Now, tactically, they do stage protest in places where they know there's going to be Antifa protest, because then they get news headlines and you hear about them like you're doing right now. Mm-hmm. But there were a number of people hurt and a number of people arrested in the protest. But I think in the bigger picture, this just is a tactic that you saw play out in Weimar Germany to polarize a nation, and it's good evidence that they do this on purpose. In that, what you'll see is you have a group like Antifa, if they go out and start a riot or start a street brawl, they get headlines. And then you get headlines, you get people are afraid of this group, and they're more likely to join a group like Patriot Prayer. And then, and so you get more people on some of these more, even extreme right-wing groups, or at least in terms of tactics, extreme right-wing groups, and then people who might have a little bit of a sympathy toward Antifa to see that threat getting worse, so they join Antifa, and eventually you kind of get both sides escalating at the expense of the center. That's definitely how you saw it play out in 1930s Germany, where every time the Antifa group staged a rally, more people joined the Nazi party. Every time the Nazi party joined a rally, more people joined Antifa, until eventually the communists and the Nazis between them controlled huge sections of the parliament in Germany, and it's the middle mainstream parties that suffered for it. Mm-hmm. And they've had more limited success here in the United States, but that is the strategy behind these rallies. You're coming up with the midterm elections, you get Antifa can get out there, get some street fights going, they get some publicity. It works as a recruitment commercial for some of their more extreme opponents, but then the extreme opponents work as a recruitment commercial for them. And so you start seeing more like you saw at Charlottesville, Virginia, a while back, where you've got these two movements just building as the nation just gets more and more divided. And so our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a book called Great Again that actually has a number of chapters on these types of things happening in America. But in particular, there's a chapter calling like Where Race Riots Are Headed that more describes in detail the Bible prophecies about events like this one in Portland. This particular event wasn't necessarily race motivated, but it just does go through the scriptures about like burning in America's cities and where this is eventually leading.
We also have an article by Michael Davis up on the website right now, Portland American Division on Display. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and literature that we talked about on the program today. You can also email your thoughts to us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
Shabbat shalom.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. Tradition means giving a vote to the most obscure of all classes, our ancestors. It is the democracy of the dead. Tradition refuses to submit to the small and arrogant oligarchy of those who merely happen to be walking about. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.